coming up on episode 257 of Wheel Bearings. We've got the Audi e-tron GT, the Ford Expedition Max, the new Chevy Colorado, the Cadillac Celestiq show car, a new EV tax incentives, and more coming up next.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. This is episode 257 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam Abual-Samid from Guidehouse Insights.
I am Nicole Wakelin from the Fast Women podcast.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from Ars Technica.
And I am coming to you today from the luxurious Days Inn and Suites in Traverse City, Michigan. I'm going to be at the Center for Automotive Research's Management Briefing Seminar for the next couple of days, which is always an interesting event. Nicole, you had a busy weekend, and what were you driving?
Wait. Before I start that, when you did your little intro, Sam, it sounded like you were about to say, I'm going to be at the Days Inn Community Center. We're going to be doing a 30-minute set with my good friend, Patton Oswalt. It did sound a little bit like you're on your comedy show tour. I'm sorry I interrupted.
Yeah. That's I've ruined the flow of the entire show. It's a side hustle. You're supposed to give away your side hustle, much, Roberto.
It did sound like you're about to tell us about your upcoming comedy special. That's going to be taping in Nevada.
Okay, enough about Sam and his comedy special. So, yes, I had an adventure last weekend. I actually had, when I say the Wakelin clan, I mean all of us. It was my husband and I, my two daughters, my oldest daughter's boyfriend. The two of them flew in from Milwaukee. My brother-in-law and his wife, niece, nephew, and a girlfriend. So 10 of us all together in a giant Airbnb up in the White Mountains in New Hampshire, which is about a two and a half hour drive north. So we wanted to have enough room for 5 grown-ups in our car, which we did. We also had to have the stuff for 5 people, copious amounts of food and a couple bottles of wine. And we also brought in his little teeny
only a couple
carrier.
Bottles?
Oh, more than a couple bottles. More than a couple. And we brought my dog, who is like the size of a small cat, and we just had him in his little carrier. So we even had a little spot for Doggo on the way up there. So all of us. And I said, hey, could I get a car that could fit all of us? And they said, sure. And they gave me a Ford Expedition Max. So it was gigantic. And my husband actually had the gall to say to me, you think we're all going to fit in that? I'm like, did you look out the window? Did you see how big the car they just left in my driveway is? And he's like, oh, that's pretty big. It was huge. So not only did we all fit in it, we put all of our stuff in it, and it still didn't even look close to full. It looked like it was half empty. We've got like little carry-on bags from my daughter and her boyfriend coming from Milwaukee, our little tote bags, all this stuff. So it was, I felt like it was the perfect test case for like, what do you do with a gigantic SUV. You put as many people as you can fit in, the family doggo in his carrier, and all of your stuff. It carried us all up there. It was super comfortable. It was super easy to drive. Before you ask, Sam, because you already ask, and I wrote it down in my notes, I got 18.3 miles per gallon. And the
combined,
yeah, and the average is supposed to be 16 city, 22 highway, 18 combined. So I was right on that. And although I did a lot of highway driving, this sucker was loaded down. It had a ton of stuff. And once you get into the White Mountains, you are literally driving up really steep mountains. So it's not exactly the easiest, most fuel efficient driving once you get off the highway. I even got to, unintentionally, because thanks for the directions, Apple Maps or Siri or whoever my husband used, there was a class 6 road between me and the Airbnb that was not designated as such until we got right to it. I'm like, this is not paved. This isn't even like a real road. This is like Bob and his buddy Sam just went out there and, you know, made a road and hack out the trees out of the way when there's a windstorm. And I drove it, and it wasn't like crazy. It wasn't like you needed a Wrangler, but it was like there were some ruts, there were some bumps and stuff. It handled it beautifully. Like it loaded down with all of this, like fully loaded. So I loaded with people and pets and stuff, took it on a highway, a long drive on the highway, took it off road for a little bit, because that was a road we used, that little stretch of road, was maybe like 3 or 4 miles in and out every time we left the Airbnb through the dirt. So it was really, it was cool to actually use a giant SUV the way that you're supposed to use a giant SUV.
You mean for something besides just running down to the corner store for a six pack?
Exactly. And I thought, okay, so if you really had a family where you, like, because there were five of us in the car, right? So if you had a family and you had three kids, like, and they're younger kids, and you really want, like, I get this. I get it. This is the first time I got it, because you could put all the kids in the car. You could put a friend or two in there with you, and you could carry all their stuff. You don't have to worry about splitting people up between two SUVs, even because there's nothing that's quite big enough to take everyone. It was brilliant. It was so much fun to drive this. My beefs are really, really tiny. So the first one is the cup holders are absolutely horrific. So when right, cup holders matter when you're driving in a car for 2 hours. So here's the thing. So you know how cup holders have those like varying degrees of little sort of springy little prongs that they will spring out to grab your cup, whether it's a tiny little soda can or a big gulp from 7-Eleven, right? These were too aggressively like, no, we're only going to hold a tin can. So when you tried to put a larger thing into it, you had to squeeze your drink too hard, and you had to kind of almost, you almost wanted to pop the top off the drink, like the lid, because it wouldn't squish. They were too strong. And it wasn't just one cup, it was both of them, because my daughter pushed her drink in and the lid actually popped off because it wanted to grab the cup too tightly. So that's my first complaint. Don't look at me like I'm crazy, Roberto. This is a serious thing. Oh,
that's a
thing.
Real complaint. That it's is a valid, yep, that fully is valid concern.
It's a genuine thing.
Things shooting out. I drink Red Bull a lot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't want those things shooting all over the place.
See, so I put my giant, extra large, skinny decaf vanilla latte from Pressed into the cup holder, and the lid shut off. And I lost a few sips across the console, which I did clean up for it. It's tidy. You'd never know. I used wipes and everything. It's all nice and tidy. But every time, I thought it was just like a fluke. Every time we put something in it, to the point that my daughter was complaining about it, that my husband wrote up front, he's like, these cup holders are terrible. I'm like, I know. I have witnessed this already. So the cup holders, and the other weird thing, the infotainment screen is amazing. It's this, I want to say 15.5 inches, but it's this huge vertical touch screen. And at the very
With the knob on the bottom. From the Mach-E? Yeah, it's 15 and a half inches.
Okay, 15 and a half. Looks great. The knob at the bottom, two things about this. First of all, the knob at the bottom, if you do use the knob, there's also touch screen things that are located very close to the knob. So you could touch them with your fingers, but if you grab the knob and your fingers happen to touch the screen at the same time, you accidentally activate touch screen things.
Did you do that? Yes, I did it.
My husband did it and my daughter did it. So it wasn't just me. So it was like you've accidentally, and it's not like you're aggressively like floundering. Where's the little button? You think you've grabbed it, but if your fingers touch it just right, you accidentally do other stuff. Here's my weird thing for the week. So we had one glitch, because sometimes glitches happen. And my screen decided for a brief time while we were at home that it was not participating in the day. It's like, no, today I sleep. And it wouldn't come on. It was completely black. I had no screen whatsoever. Like dead. Once I turned the car off for a while and turned it back on, it was kind of like a computer. Like it reset itself. It came back. It wasn't, you wouldn't, power wouldn't come on. It was like, there was nothing. It was completely gonzo, right? A little bit frustrating. It would frustrate you, right?
Well, especially given that the climate controls are in the touch interface, which
exactly.
Is why those things should always be physical controls. They yes. should never be in a touchscreen.
Yes. 110%.
This is why.
This is it. And I experienced it firsthand. We got in the car. We'd had the AC set at a reasonable level, got out, did our thing, came back in. It was like 85, 90 degrees. So now the car is an inferno. I can't make the AC go any higher than the nice little calm level it was at when we got out of the car. I literally can't turn up the air conditioning. So you can't do anything. So if that happened,
did you try using voice to say turn down the temperature?
Voice wouldn't recognize nothing.
The whole system was locked up.
Completely gone. It was completely locked out there. I've tried voice. I'm trying every permutation and combination that I can think of. Like, is there any way I can get through to this and get it to like kick back in? It wouldn't. No, it was just, this is just like a brief drive from downtown in my town to my house. And once I turned it off, we left it off for a little while, didn't need to turn it on for a couple of hours. When we turned it back on, it was fine. So whatever it was, kicked itself out and reset itself. But I've experienced that, like, oh my gosh, you literally cannot adjust the HVAC. You can't do anything once that happens. So now I am pro also having buttons. If you want to put it in there, have at it, but also have hard buttons so that if something goes wrong with that, you can still adjust your AC. Because it was like in the summer, just kind of a pain in the butt. We left the windows rolled down a little bit to let the worst of the hot air out. And then eventually the AC at that low level was enough. But if it was like winter and you couldn't turn on your heat, that's a whole different story.
Or your windshield defoggers. Or-
exactly.
Oh, yeah, so, your defogger.
Yeah. So I'd never realized how bad that could be until that one moment. And I feel like I'm picking on it. I loved this card. This was a weird glitch, but it was one of those, like, now I get why you don't want to design something.
Do you
that
love
way.
The card, though? It's like loving somebody that you went out with and they were kind of a jerk to you a few times.
He was
and
just
you're
a
just
jerk.
Like, yeah, but.
He was just a jerk once. There was one time he was a jerk, but all the
one
other
time. One time he just didn't do the
one
thing.
One time he threw my drink at me by accident. One time he refused to talk to me.
He forgot to put the toilet seat back down.
Right. So otherwise it was okay. So I'm not going to like call that, like, I felt like I needed, I don't want to call it out and make it sound like, oh, this is terrible. This broke. It was more like, this is what happens if something like that breaks, like something to really consider. If that goes, suddenly you've lost control of your HVAC, which is not fun. Otherwise, other than the 25 minute somewhat hot ride back from downtown to my house with my daughter and I trying everything we could to get it to work. I really did like it. And I thought it was a great car. It was a very smooth ride. It was really nice to drive this for the hours that I drove it. It was fantastic. And it was a couple hours there and a couple hours back. So we all liked it. Easy to get in and out of, easy to climb from the third row into the second row for my daughter. She wasn't like having to contort herself to get back and forth. So that was easy. So yeah. So all in all, thumbs up, Ford Expedition Max.
Max.
What trim level was it?
I had the limited 4x4.
Okay. I was just wondering if you had the Timberline, because, you know, that would have been interesting to see how the Timberline behaved on that, Class 6 road, you said?
Class
that-
6 road, yeah. No, it really was off-road, but it wasn't. Like, you wouldn't have wanted to take a sedan down it just because there were ruts and stuff that were too deep and you'd have bottomed out. But it wasn't like you were rock crawling or anything. But it was, you know, loose gravel, a few little steep bits here and there, some ruts. You had to pay attention to what you're doing. Apparently a log or tree had fallen across the road and somebody had cut it. It was like dragged to either side, just lined up nicely, becoming a little guardrail. My brother-in-law was driving a Jeep Wrangler, and he's not an off-road guy. And I was having so much fun flying down this little thing in my Expedition. I looked and he was gone. I'm like, there were no turnoffs, right? I didn't lose John, did I? He should be fine. He's in a Wrangler.
It's also probably all the dust you kicked up. No one wants to drive too fast.
It was actually, it wasn't dusty because we'd had some rain. Everything was pretty tamped down. There were some puddles, as the guys that go to clean it will discover when there's like sploosh all over the sides of this.
So he's just not used to, you know, how to actually drive off-road like you are.
Yeah.
He is not. So he said I was driving too fast, and I said, not in my world, I wasn't.
No. Exactly. Anything, you were driving too slow because there was all the people in the car.
Exactly. I was being cautious because they were like civilians with me.
Normal. And how much was the Expedition? Did you say the price?
I did not say the price. The price for this one, as equipped, was $84,660. So it is not a cheap date.
No. Nope.
But and sometimes a good chunk it'll make you hot.
One of the I'm just looking at the equipment package. Yeah. There was a really cool panoramic vista roof, they call it. It's like the whole length of the thing. That roof was $9,000?
What? No.
By itself, or was that part of a package?
Wait a minute. There's another thing here. Panoramic vista roof and the stealth edition package.
The hell?
It was just black. What did the stealth edition do? Did it make it black?
It had black
probably
rims.
Black wheels.
Okay, for the
and
sunroof
trim.
And a black. Yeah, that package is $9,000.
What a rip!
That's,
I'm just going to say it.
That's a lot.
That's a rip, and people will pay for it because they want a black car.
I guess they probably will. It was fun. If I was looking to spend $86,000 on, like, really and really needed that, I mean, that is a huge vehicle. If you really need that much, it did the job, and it was fun, and it let me do a little bit of off-road stuff, and yeah, thumbs up. Even though it was a little bit of a cranky boyfriend, as Roberto's pointed out.
Cranky boyfriend. I'm not going to keep you cool.
I'm not going to let you put your drink here. No.
You're not the boss of me. Don't push me around.
Yeah, I'll show you. No HVAC.
All right. What about you, Robbie? What did you drive?
I drove nothing. I got nothing to tell you. I didn't. I got nothing out front right now. I'm just trying to catch up. I have a lot of non-driving articles. Also, I have some driving articles I have to write. So, in order to keep myself from falling further behind, I have opted to finish my work before taking on more work, like an adult. This doesn't happen very often.
But look at you being all responsible. I know. I'm so proud of you.
I know. And of course, now I'm like, I got to reach out to those fleet guys and see if I can get that one car in.
Wait a minute. I need to drive stuff. That's part of my job. I should probably do that.
Oh, yeah. That's my job. So, nothing.
Well, when I got back from our vacation, my wife and I got back from our vacation a week and a half ago. We had dropped off the Mach-E GT at the airport in San Francisco, and back in Detroit, we picked up an Audi e-tron GT. And so had my first opportunity to drive, you know, one of these vehicles that's based on the same platform as the Porsche Taycan. I will say this is a fantastic looking car, and I really enjoyed driving it. This was not the RS. Just the standard e-tron GT. And so it had, I think, about 580 or so horsepower, something in that ballpark. 93 kilowatt hour battery pack. It is rated, EPA rated at 238 miles of range, which doesn't seem like that much for a car this size with this size of battery pack. But in fact, when we got into it, it was showing 260 miles of range, and it was easily getting at least that much. Because when I actually did a lot of highway driving with it. On the day after we got back, I actually had, two appointments in Detroit, one in the morning and one in the evening. So I drove to Detroit and back twice that day and did a bunch of other driving around. Drove to a party in Bloomfield Hills on Saturday night. Did all that without charging it. And by the time I got back to near my home in Ypsilanti on Saturday night, I had put and it was mostly highway driving. So, not the most efficient for an EV. And, if you're going to drive on the highway in Michigan, you got to keep up with the flow of traffic, which rarely ever goes at the speed limit. And the speed limit in that area is 70 miles an hour. It was not, ideal for maximizing the range, but I had already driven over 230 miles in that car and still had 30 miles of range showing. So, if I had had more around town urban driving, I could have easily, I think, gotten probably over 280, maybe 290 miles, in more mixed driving conditions with this thing. This is something, from other tests that have been done of both the Taycan and the e-tron GT, everybody's been, way exceeding the EPA range numbers for these vehicles. So clearly Porsche and Audi, were very conservative in their testing to make sure that they didn't overpromise and underdeliver. They wanted to go the other way around. And it's definitely worked. The car I had the Prestige package, which is $7,200 on top of the $99,900 base price, and then it also had the Performance package, which gets you 20-inch five double spoke wheels, summer tires, Audi laser light headlights, e-torque vectoring plus, high gloss black grille. The car was white, so white with the black grille and the black trim. Had sort of the Star Wars Stormtrooper kind of vibe about it. full leather interior for another $4,000, and the technology features, you know, and a $1,045 destination charge brought the grand total to $118,740.
Wow.
So this is not an inexpensive car. But
And yet those packages are still cheaper than the Expeditions. Like, hey, you want a glass roof and some black rims?
I know, right? I really need to look it up. What else is that stealth package?
There's got
to
be more.
I'm going to look it up and see if it's talking.
Maybe it comes with a bag of like $5,000 in the trunk.
and the Audi did have a full glass roof as well. So, you know, there's that. You know, I really enjoyed driving this thing. You know, the seats were fantastic. You know, the front seats were great. You know, the Prestige package gets you massaging seats, which is always a nice thing when you're spending a lot of time in the car. It had adaptive cruise and Audi's active lane assist, which is, you know, a lane keeping assist. It's not a lane centering system. So, you know, what you're getting there is not something like the, not something like autopilot. You can't, you definitely have to keep your hands on the wheel with this. But, you know, that's fine. You know, I don't have an issue with that because you probably should keep your hands on the wheel anyway. The performance package adds rear wheel steering, you know, so this thing has great stability on the road when you're, you know, it does a little bit of in-phase steering when you're changing lanes on the highway. It feels really good. It's not quite as quick as the Taycan, but you know, it'll still do 0 to 60 in about right around 3 seconds. And one thing that's interesting in this one, because you know, it's the same powertrain you get in the Taycan, which means that on the rear motor there's a 2-speed gearbox, as opposed to just a single speed reduction gearbox that you get on most EVs. And you know, when you put it into, you know, the performance mode, you know, there's several different drive modes. I think Audi calls it dynamic mode. And you use launch control. Launch control is dead simple to use in this thing. Put your left foot on the brake pedal, hold it down, put your right foot on the accelerator, push it all the way to the floor, remove your left foot from the brake pedal, and go. And you can feel it when it shifts, which is an unusual feeling in an EV, because usually in an EV it's just completely seamless.
Yeah, just one like whoosh forward. Yeah, you never feel anything. You're just suddenly you're moving.
Yeah, you can definitely feel it when it shifts in this thing. When you've got it in eco mode, I think it keeps it just in the higher gear all the time, because you know the acceleration doesn't feel quite as brutal off the line. And you never feel it shift. And then most driving, you know, and then pretty much anything but the hardest acceleration, you're never going to feel any shifting. But in that, you know, when it is that, you know, really hard acceleration, you can feel it shift. One complaint I do have about this car is I do wish it was a hatchback. It's got that sleek fastback shape, you know, looks like a four-door coupe, but the trunk opening is kind of small, and the trunk is rather shallow. I was able to get, you know, when we returned from our trip, I was able to get 2 carry-on bags in the trunk. I had to move the bag for the charging cable to get them in there, but I was able to fit them in. But you know, it was a tight squeeze in there. And I ended up putting the 2 backpacks in the back seat. So it's a fairly small trunk. And, you know, if it did have a hatchback, you know, like an A7 or an A5, you'd have a lot more usable rear cargo space. Back seat is also not especially roomy. I was able to sit back there. My head was not touching the glass ceiling. And my knees were not quite touching the front of the back of the front seat, the driver's seat. And I'm, you know, about 5'11" or so. So I was able to fit back there, but it didn't have the kind of massive capacity that you would get in something like a Lucid Air, you know, which feels incredibly roomy in the back seat. This is definitely tighter, you know, and I mean, this is a classic grand touring car. So it's not a hardcore sports car, but it's, fast transportation in style and comfort, and it's gorgeous. I love the way this thing looks. I probably wouldn't choose one in white if I were buying one, because white's
kind of boring. What color would you pick? What would you pick?
I would probably pick, one of the probably multiple shades of silver or gray that they have. I don't think that they have, I don't think Audi has any really bold colors on this thing.
They have the red. The red looks really nice. It's like a dark.
Do they have a red?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's, I forgot about that.
They have the red.
Is that only on the RS, though, or is it also?
Oh, maybe it is always only on the RS. I've driven a lot of them. I've driven all the variants, so now I don't know which is which anymore. Look at me bragging about driving a car.
Fine, whatever.
I've
driven.
Maybe it might just be
the RS, actually.
Yeah, if there was a red or something, or a blue, I would go with a bolder color. The white's fine, but it like I say, it wouldn't be my first choice. And I would probably never buy a white car just because there's too many of those. But other than that, it's not an inexpensive car. It's fairly pricey. But if you're looking for something that's quick and very stylish and, comfortable for a couple with, room to take another couple along with you, when you want to go out for dinner, this is definitely something to consider if you're looking for, a really premium grand touring, coupe style car. I would also prefer, just a pure two-door coupe. But it is what it is. Unfortunately, most manufacturers don't sell enough of those to justify it. So that's the way it goes. But, it definitely gets a lot better range than what the Monroney indicates. I wouldn't worry about the 238 mile stated range, because you can definitely go a lot farther than that. And, if you were driving it fairly tamely, which, who wants to in a car like this? But if you were, you could probably get close to 300 miles if you really wanted to. So that's the Audi e-tron GT. Oh, and one other thing that I found quite surprising is the ride quality was actually really good. Considering the type of car this is, I drove it over some pretty rough pavement, and I wouldn't call it supple, but very well controlled and not at all harsh. It was very comfortable to drive.
It's the more tame version of what the Taycan is, what you're
getting. Yeah.
Like if you drive the Taycan, the Taycan is a lot more aggressive, both accelerator and suspension wise. The e-tron GT is when you're like, I just, I want to go fast, but I also want to feel pampered.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right.
Pampering. I deserve some pampering.
A little pampering.
Yeah. We all deserve some pampering once in a while.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. You work hard for your money.
You deserve it.
You should treat yourself right.
Treat yourself a little pampering. Okay, I have an answer too for you guys, by the way, is in the limited stealth performance package after I dug through 8,900 pages worth of media and consumer site information. It just says the sunroof and the special stealth package on my Monroney, but the equipment thing is actually the stealth performance equipment group, which is the little code number. It gets a high output version of that 3.5 liter V6. I cannot for the life of me find out how much more horsepower that adds, but it does get a little, and a sport tuned suspension. So it gets a few little performancey bits in addition to 99% of it being black stuff, black trim.
It's probably about 10 or 20 horsepower, I think.
Yeah, I can't find it. I'm looking for it and I cannot find out what the horsepower increase actually is. But so it does get the high output. That's so you're getting a little bit more engine, a little bit more performance, looks like, with the sport tuned suspension stuff. So it's a little bit more than just the black plus some panoramic roof for $9,000. You get a little bit of performance.
A little something, something.
Yeah, Ford sells a bunch of different variations of that 3.5 liter EcoBoost V6, and they all range from about 400 to 450 horsepower. So it's going to be somewhere in that range. It's probably,
Oh, wait, I got it. I mean, 440.
Oh,
440 horsepower. Okay. I don't know what the regular one is. So I found the high output.
I think it's 400.
440. Okay, so it's 40 more horsepower. So a little chunk of extra horsepower. That's not a bad thing. So there you go. A little extra horsies. So that's good.
That's worth $9,000.
Yeah, totally worth $9,000. That and
the black rim.
Trim. Mm-hmm.
And then the roof.
You get glass roof. You have a black headlamp and fog lamp bezels.
Ooh. I mean, you didn't say anything about bezels.
I know. I missed out on the bezels. There's unique interior stitching in red, but mostly it's pretty stuff and 40 horsepower.
Pretty stuff and 40 horsepower. You got $9,000. Here you go.
Here you go.
All right. Let's get into some stories for the week. one thing that we forgot to talk about last week, because we had a bunch of stuff that we were catching up on, and I forgot to put it on. I actually had intended to put it on the rundown, completely forgot, is the Cadillac Celestiq, which, Nicole, were you at the GM EV Day in March of 2020?
I was not.
Okay. So I think I was the only one of the three of us that was there. This was an event they did in one of the last, I think the last event that GM did before the lockdown, where they showed us a whole bunch of the upcoming EVs. And they showed us a clay model of the Celestiq. It was of the 12 cars that they showed us, it was the last one that they took the silk off of, you know, and it said, oh, and one more thing, kind of an old time Steve Jobs thing, you know, one more special thing coming. And they didn't give us much detail about it, except, you know, they said, you know, this is going to be a hand-built ultra-luxury car. The one they had at the time didn't even have an interior in it, so we had no idea what the interior was going to look like. We only saw the exterior. And now they've shown off the Celestiq show car, which is by all accounts going to be essentially the same as the production model that's going to be coming later next year. This is going to be a hand built, you know, personalized for every customer. I think they're only planning on building a few hundred a year of these. So about the same pace that they're building Hummers right now, apparently. everybody who saw it at the time was pretty impressed with most of it, most of the design. What did the two of you think of this?
I mean, it looks absolutely beautiful. The interior, it's funny that they didn't have the interior to show you at that day you were talking about, because the interior of this thing is amazing. Is that actually that red? Red. It's very red.
It's a little too red.
It's very red.
It is very, very red.
That's my issue with
the car. It's a little bit like Hugh Hefner's smoking jacket kind of situation happening in there. It's like, it's very red.
It's very red. A little too red. A little too much red. But that said, I like that they call it a flagship sedan when it's clearly a wagon. Just call it a wagon.
Well, it's not a wagon, though.
It looks like a wagon. Come on.
I mean, let me look at it.
Do we have a picture? Does it have a hatchback?
Yes, it looks like it does in this picture.
I don't remember. I don't. I don't know.
I can see the little line. He's from the.
It looks.
The roof.
I know. That's what I'm doing. I'm looking at like a little seam, and it looks
that little
like
seam. And it pops up, and that's where you put your stuff in when you're going to Wally World with the kids.
In your custom hand done. Commissioned car that I would never put a child in ever.
Well, the kids when they're older. They're 19, the kids when they're old 20. Enough to they want to go to a, you know, somewhere across the country. Little road
it
trip.
It really is absolutely beautiful, though. It's even, as I'm picking on the red, it's very red inside, but it's a stunning car. The details, if it actually looks like this in production, if it's this detailed and has this kind of personality to it, it's an absolutely gorgeous car. Did they give pricing on this?
It's going to be around $300,000.
Oh, sure. For $300,000, it is going to look exactly like this. It's gorgeous.
They've got to hand-build it.
They're hand-building it. $300,000.
And you'll be able to personalize, you know, if the red doesn't work for you on the interior, you can make it any color you want.
So would you do this $300,000 for a Cadillac? There's a lot of cars you could buy for $300,000. Would you buy the Cadillac, or are there other $300,000 cars that you might buy first?
So, you know, for 300 grand, you could get something like this, or a Mercedes Maybach, mm-hmm. you know, or what else?
There's some Aston Martins out there that you could buy.
Rolls-Royce Ghost. Mm-hmm. You know, some Aston Martins. I mean, I would seriously consider this.
Well, all those other vehicles. Well, I mean, how many Ghosts they make a year? Like 12?
Like, does Cadillac have enough of the sort of cachet to pull off a $300,000 car?
Well, I think
for the crew that buys $300,000 cars.
There's only going to be a few of them. There'll be people who will buy them just because it's like Supreme. True. It's like a Supreme drop, but for a really expensive car.
Okay.
Like, there's only going to be X amount of Celestics available. And so people are going to buy them in order to be.
It's not Celestique. It's really just Celestic.
It's Celestic.
I don't think I've heard it spoken before. Celestic. I'm going to say Celestique in my head all the time because I feel like that's what it looks like.
You're free to pronounce it any way you want.
Yeah.
So when we saw it 2 years ago, the most controversial thing that everybody, I mean, from the front three quarters and from the front, you know, everybody unreservedly loved it. The mm-hmm. one thing that kind of got everybody that they weren't sure about was the look of the C pillar, the rear quarter. What mm-hmm. do you think of that? I mean, you've got this massive piece of sheet metal there. For that,
is it really that solid? I'm trying to get another picture.
It's solid. Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Did it look awkward in person? Is this one of those, or you're saying it did look awkward in person? Because I'm looking at it, sometimes it doesn't, you know, looking at an image on a computer isn't the same thing as the real live version, but it still looks kind of solid like that. That's a lot of metal for a C-pillar.
It is. You know, granted, you know, this has got, you know, a similar kind of look to the Lyric. You know, where, so you've got this, you know, sort of hockey stick shaped horizontal light that goes up the pillar. And then it's kind of scalloped out behind that, you know, so it's not just a flat panel there, you know, it's got some contouring to it, which breaks it up a little bit.
Okay.
But, you know, it's still, you know, I don't know yet. I haven't made up my mind yet about the rear three quarter view.
I can see where it would be controversial. I want to see it for realsies with the light, how the light plays against it and how it just looks in person.
Right. And we saw it in the design dome. So,
yeah,
we'll have to see what it looks like outside.
But it is overall, it's beautiful. All the detailing, the details in this car are phenomenal. Like everywhere you look, there is a little detail. It's gorgeous. It's really pretty.
And you've got a full width display, you know, pillar to pillar display, which will be a first for Cadillac.
Wait, what's the HVAC system situation though?
Is it all in that touchscreen? Because if it is, I'm out.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We'll have to see. It's hard to tell from these images. So we'll be seeing more of this in the coming months. And then we might even see it at the Detroit Auto Show in September.
Hmm.
I suspect they'll probably have it there. I think they may have it at Pebble Beach. Are you going to Pebble, Robbie?
Yeah, I'll be at Pebble. So if you see me, say hi, and I'll give you a low five. No more high fives. I've decided high fives are not cool anymore.
Oh,
low five. Actually, high fives are never cool. I just like to do it
ironically.
They're
never cool when it's you because nobody can reach you. When you do a high five, it's like, I have to jump.
A low five's better. So if you're at Pebble and you see me, give me a low five.
Okay.
Or a dollar. One of those.
All right.
A dollar.
So the Celestic is riding on using the Ultium electric power system, so the Ultium battery, it's probably going to have at least 100 kilowatt hour battery pack, probably more for the high end versions. Because they're going to be aiming for, you know, probably 350 to 400 mile range with this thing. So we'll be waiting for more details coming up.
Yeah.
All right. Last week, GM also revealed another new model, this time not electric, the 2023 Chevy Colorado, their updated midsize truck. Do you guys have a chance to take a look at this?
A little bit. The C-pillar is so much smaller, though. I don't know if I like it. It's kind of...
Well, you could get the Desert Boss that has, you know, the sport bar with the sail panels on there. So that kind of emulates the C-pillar.
All right. Yeah, that's fine then.
Okay. So the new Colorado and presumably the GMC Canyon, which we haven't seen yet, are about the same overall size as the current generation models, but they stretch the wheelbase 3 inches, most of which goes to the front end. So you got less front overhang. They're trying to make this thing more off-road capable than before. They've added a Desert Boss trim on top of the ZR2 package that they already have on the current generation. So that's got the fancy Multimatic dampers with the remote reservoirs and all kinds of other cool stuff. One interesting change is no more V6 and no more diesel engine in the Colorado. Just three different variations of the 2 liter the 2.7 liter four cylinder turbo that launched in the Silverado a couple of years ago, ranging from 230 to 320 horsepower. Have either of you driven vehicles with that 2.7 liter turbo in it?
I'm trying to think of the Silverado. No, I've only driven the V6.
I'm going to say I don't remember, which is terrible, but I don't remember. I don't believe I have.
Okay. Well, it was fine in the Silverado. I was less impressed with it in the Cadillac CT4 V, but you know, that's probably just cause it's not really well suited to a car like the CT4 V. But you know, it'll be fine. You know, it's reasonably smooth. You know, should get decent fuel economy. And you know, the Ranger only comes with a four-cylinder turbo engine as well. So, you know, you'll have a brand new Ranger, brand new Colorado and Canyon, maybe a Ram Dakota coming at some point, and there's a new Toyota Tacoma coming soon. So the midsize truck segment's getting pretty interesting again.
Yeah. Which is good because people love those. I mean, sometimes you want a truck, but you don't want yourself a Silverado. You don't want an F-150. You just need a little bit of truck. Here's your little bit of truck.
I'd like to see more smaller trucks, like the Maverick.
I like little ones?
I like little trucks. You slam them and put some big rims on them, put a big speaker box.
They still carry mulch.
They still carry mulch. Still carry mulch.
Unless you fill up the bed with speakers.
Oh, you fill up the bed with speakers. There you go. But the speakers only, so the depth of let's say, 12-inch, you don't need the entire bed, so you can leave like a little layer. You can slide the mulch underneath.
Oh, okay. So leave a gap under the speakers?
Yeah, leave a gap under the speakers.
Shove about half a dozen bags of mulch under there?
Boom, boom. And then when you need to get that last one out, you just like park on a hill and then take off real fast, and then the mulch will slide out.
Right out the back.
I'm solving problems here. I hope Ford's listening to this.
Well, actually, speaking of the Maverick, I don't have it on the list here, but this morning Ford announced the Maverick Tremor coming for the 23 model year, which is basically they took all the hardware, the cool hardware from the Bronco Sport, and put it on the Maverick. So you've got it's got an extra inch of ride height. It's got the twin clutch locking rear differential, and then the 2 liter EcoBoost 4-cylinder with 250 horsepower. Did you guys take a look at that one?
Yeah, I saw it. At first, I was like, oh, really? And then I looked at it. I'm like, eh, all right. Here's a fun side story. I was at, I don't know, somewhere, and someone pulled into a parking lot with a Maverick, but they had a Raptor badge put on it.
Just to screw with people?
Was it just a base XL with the steel wheels?
No, it wasn't the base XL. It was the Lariat. So they had thrown all the stuff on, and then they went out, and they like went online, they found the Raptor badge, and they like adhered it to the truck.
That's kind of awesome.
And it was, the sad thing was slightly askew. So they spent all this money, and it was just askew, just slightly crooked enough.
Right.
Yeah. Aww. I was like, oh, man, you did all that work. Oh, well. But the Tremor looks nice.
I think it looks good.
Okay.
I'll allow it.
Oh, yeah, okay. We'll allow it, Sam. They can continue production. Go ahead, Ford. We've approved.
Okay. Nicole and Robbie approve. I'll send a note to Mike Levine and, you know, tell him.
Let him know.
Mike, it's cool.
Tell him, it's okay. Mike. Go ahead. We're cool with it. Go.
I was on the okay. I was on the you fence. Can, then I saw it. Okay, fine.
You can begin taking orders and start building them.
Well, they can't even build the ones they have already made.
That's true.
I go to the Ford site. I don't know why I was looking up the Maverick. Maybe because I like the Maverick. I'm like, ooh, I should buy one of these one day. And it's like, yeah, you're not getting a Maverick anytime soon, buddy. That's essentially what the site says.
Does it really?
Yeah, if you go, it's the same thing with the Ioniq 5. You go to the Ioniq 5, and it's like, mm. It's like, you sure?
Well, Ford had stopped taking orders for the Maverick and a few other models a couple of months ago. And I guess as of today, they've reopened the order books again for the 23 models. So they're starting to take orders for the 23s now.
Cool.
That's right. Good. Oh, yeah. I see the little warning. Due to a combination of high demand and global supply chain constraints, not all models and trims features are available. Contact your dealer. It does give you a little warning. You have to acknowledge it. Acknowledge.
I acknowledge it. I'm probably not going to get the car I want.
Contact your dealer and ask him how much of a markup he's going to put on the MSRP.
Yeah. What is this actually going to cost me? It says $20,995 here. What's your price?
Well, $20,995 plus another $20,995. And you're out the door.
There you go.
Speaking of which, both GM and Ford are, you know, trying, we'll see how successful they are, to limit, you know, the gouging, dealer gouging, and people buying these things and flipping them for more money. The latest thing that the GM did is they've announced that on several of their most popular models, like the Hummer, the Escalade V, and the Corvette Z06, if you buy one of these and then resell it within 12 months, they are not going to allow transfer of the warranties on these things. I mean, usually, you know, when you buy a car and then you sell it, you know, as long as the warranties are still in effect, you know, the original factory warranties are still in effect, it transfers over to subsequent owners. But that won't be the case if you sell any of these vehicles within a year after you buy them. You know, that would presumably discourage people from paying a premium to get these things if they know there's not going to be any warranty on it. What do you think about that strategy?
I get what they're trying to do.
The idea is that the dealerships are using fake names to buy cars, and then they turn around and sell them. And so that's sort of like, hey, we're going to stop that. And, of course, there are people who are buying cars and then putting them on the auction sites and doing that. But at the same time, there are people, you know, that's the unintended consequences of this rule is that someone buys a Z06 and then they get laid off.
That's what I'm thinking.
You know, there's a medical emergency in their family. And now they're trying to sell a car. And, oh, by the way, when you buy this car for me, it's not going to have the warranty anymore, which now it's not only punishing the seller, it's punishing the buyer. So I feel like they're sort of dancing around the actual issue, which is the dealers ripping people off and figuring out new and exciting ways. And instead of just saying, hey, if you do this as a dealer, you're not going to get cars anymore. Instead, they're like, well, how about we do this thing instead? So it's not, I don't know.
I feel like if they do this, it's to stop the dealers doing what they're doing. But the dealers will find a way to get around it if they can, and they'll, you know, continue whatever their individual dealer's business as usual is. But like you said, Roberto, it's the guy who gets laid off and can't afford to keep his Corvette is now suddenly stuck when, honest to goodness, he wanted that Corvette and now he can't keep it. But now to sell it is a problem because he can't transfer the warranty. I feel like it's going to hurt the people it's least intended to hurt.
Yeah.
You know?
The dealer will figure something out, too. They're like, hey, you can buy a third-party warranty on this car, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would guess that, you know, GM will probably build in some kind of flexibility so that, you know, if you can, you know, if you were, you know, an actual consumer that bought this thing and you can provide some evidence that, you know, look, I lost my job. I can't make the payments on this.
Yeah.
You know, I need to sell it or trade it in. You know, there's probably a mechanism that will, that they'll, you know, they'll, they can judge, you know, they can make a judgment call on a case by case basis and say, mm-hmm. okay, for, you know, in this case, you know, because you did in fact get laid off and you need to sell it, then, you know, we'll allow the warranty transfer on that. You know, so, I mean, GM's got the discretion to be able to do that if they want to do that.
If they have the people to do it. Because now you're like, oh, yeah. Now I'm waiting for, well, what's going on? Well, I'm trying to sell my car, but I can't sell it for 2 months. Well, I'm still waiting for GM to say yay or nay.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, my kids don't have any food. No, I'm just kidding. I just got.
They're all starving, but I got this really snazzy Corvette in the driveway.
I just.
Yeah. We might be being slightly more dramatic than what the typical consumer will have to endure. But
you know, yeah. I mean, hopefully, you know, if you've got the wherewithal to buy, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 car, you might have enough savings. Hopefully, you've got enough savings, you know, to get you through a couple of months. You know, if you lose your job. You know, hopefully you're not living paycheck to paycheck if you're buying a car like this. I mean, I guess if you are living paycheck to paycheck and you're buying a car like this,
that was a bad idea.
Maybe you should rethink your priorities a little bit.
yeah, that's like, possible. Well,
I only got enough money for me and this Cadillac Escalade V.
That's all I got, man.
That's all I got. I got enough money. I'm at razor's edge. Razor's edge. Living on the razor's edge of life. It's just me, okay. This one studio apartment. And this Escalade
I love the
V.
Backstory you've created for our consumer here.
Gotta look good. Gotta look good.
All right. Last excuse me. Last news item for the week is Senators Schumer and Manchin apparently finally came to an agreement late last week on a new tax and budget bill that includes some updates to the EV tax incentive system. There's some pretty substantial changes. First of all, they're eliminating the 200,000 vehicle sales cap to be eligible for incentives. And so, you know, manufacturers, you know, at least through the end of 2031, will be able to sell as many EVs as they can, and customers will be able to get tax breaks on them. But they've also made some other changes in the eligibility for these tax breaks. For example, now there's an income cap. So it's $150,000 income, you know, income for single filers, $300,000 for couples filing jointly. So if you make more than $150,000 or $300,000, you won't be able to get a tax break on an EV. You'll have to pay full price. There's also changes in the way that it's being done. So instead of a tax credit that you file on your next year's tax return, which means that you may or may not actually be able to get the full amount back depending on how much your income is, the new system allows for a transfer of the credit to the dealer. So dealers have to register with the IRS to be able to do this, but they, if they're registered and the vehicle qualifies, the customer can transfer the $7,500 tax credit to the dealer and then get that as an immediate discount. So basically, you get a point of sale rebate, which goes, you know, it's a discount to the sale price, which means that you can actually, you know, where the current system. The tax credit doesn't lower your monthly payment on the car because you still have to pay the full price and then get the money back later from the government. Now you can lower the upfront price of the car and get a lower monthly payment. So EVs will be potentially affordable to a lot more people. And then there's also a cap on the sticker on the MSRP of the car. So for cars, it's going to be $55,000. So if a car, If an electric car costs more than $55,000, no tax break for you. And for trucks and SUVs, it's $80,000. You won't be able to get a tax break on a Model S Plaid or a Lucid Air, but you know you can for a Kona EV or a Mach-E or a Blazer or something like that, or a Model 3 or a Model Y. You'd be able to get those. And then it's also limited to EVs that are built in North America. You won't be able to get a tax break on a BMW i4 or an iX because they're built in Germany. You won't be able to get a break on a VinFast that's built in Vietnam. But if it's built in Canada, U.S., or Mexico, you will be able to get the tax credit. What do you think of this new system?
My only issue is the fact that there's a $50,000 cap on sedans and an $80,000 cap on SUVs and trucks. Like, why? That's my biggest issue. Everything else, for the most part, I'm fine with. I mean, instant money, that's great. The used car, credit, $4,000.
$4,000.
Used EV, which most people who can't afford a new car, I mean, I've never actually gone out and purchased a new car. I've leased two new cars, but I've never purchased a new car. For people who make money I make or less and you can't afford a new car, you can go out and get a used one. And get a $4,000 credit, which is really nice. I'm also fine with the capping it, you know, for $150,000. If you're buying let's say you're buying an Audi e-tron GT, you don't need $7,500. You're buying a hundred and something thousand dollar car. That's you're fine. You're doing okay. It's the people. I think these at this point, it's trying to get. You know, people who aren't making, you know, $200,000 and buying Plaids for funsies. It's everyone else. I'm also happy they got rid of the cap.
I think it's a little unnecessarily complicated. Like, it's this much for cars, it's this much for SUVs. It has to be made in the U.S. If you're making X over X dollars, you can't get it. If you're making under X, you get this. If it's a used car, you get that. I feel like genuinely the average consumer is going to look at it and go, what?
It's not that hard, really. I mean, if you make 150 and 300 for two, $300,000 for two people, 150 for one person, the 7,500, it's the same as it was before, except now you get money, like right away. It's really the SUV versus like car thing. That's the thing that really bothers me.
Why does that bother you? What? It's just is more for one
because
than the other?
SUVs and vans and trucks have always got like this wonderful leg up. And being, you know, there's fewer emission standards, this whole thing. And then, you know, just telling people, you know what, just keep buying gigantic vehicles that you probably don't really need in the rest of your life. You're like, it's cool. We're gonna reward you for buying a vehicle that's less efficient than the sedans because they're so much larger. They have, you know, higher drag coefficient. And what's the article about the Hummer EV getting the same amount of CO2 or less than a Chevy Malibu. I mean, big trucks are still big trucks. They're not going to be as efficient. And so you're sort of saying, hey, you're going to get the more efficient sedan. Well, we're going to lower the amount we'll allow you to spend on that sedan that's more efficient than the large truck, the SUV. The vans, I don't know. No one buys vans anymore.
Commercial customers do.
What's that?
Commercial fleets do.
That's a whole other thing because that's a whole
okay
that field
and actually to your point, Nicole, about this being a little bit more complicated than before, there are some additional complications that I didn't get into. Not every vehicle will actually be eligible for a full $7,500. Because there's some rules in there about the domestic content of the batteries.
I was wondering about that. Like,
so they split the $7,500 in half. So $3,750 is for an EV that's built in North America, and then the other $3,750 is based on the domestic content of the battery critical materials.
Oh, good gravy.
So if it reaches a certain threshold, then you get that other $3,750. And if all the battery materials come from China, then right. you won't get that. So
you have to look at where the actual materials in the battery of the vehicle that you're considering buying is versus the other battery materials from the other vehicle you're considering buying combined with where that vehicle is produced.
They'll publish a list of here's the cars that are eligible and how much of a break you got on each one.
Because it's somewhere between also for PHEVs and hybrids as well. I mean, you're still getting the – and that whole system is like, well, it's based on battery capacity. So you can get a PHEV that gets $7,500 because the battery capacity is just a little bit north of what they've come up – of a number they came up with like 10 years ago. So it's always going to be – I mean, it's always going to be like slightly confusing, and it's always just like, okay, these are the cars I want. You narrow it down to the two cars, and then you figure out how much you're going to get back for each of them.
I still think it's confusing. I would love to see the government just make a rule that was like X or Y. That's it. Buy this, do that. Like as opposed to, but if this, then that. It's like there's a decision tree there that has like 50 branches. I want a decision tree that has two. I'm buying an EV. Yes, you get your refund, your rebate. I'm not buying an EV. No, you don't. Done. That's what I want my decision tree to be. I don't want to then be like, well, if this, then that, like little circles, and some of them are diamonds and some of them are, well, what day of the week was it? Was the sun high? What was the temperature? Like, no. Are you buying an EV?
Well, it'll be a list of here's the EVs that are available. Here's the discount that's available on each one. Simple as that.
That's right.
And then you can decide, you know, how much each one's, you know, if it's something you can afford or not.
Yeah. Rich consumers
won't have to go through all those details.
Rich people know how they're doing. They're going to be like, oh, I'm rich. I don't get this discount. Oh, well, I'm rich.
Okay.
why don't we get into some of the question, listener questions then.
Okay.
And the first one, which is actually the last one on the list here, from John W. Halkius, he actually had a question about this, about the tax credit, the proposed tax credit. And keep in mind that at least as of the time we're recording this on Monday night, this has not actually been voted on by Congress yet. And it's still possible that Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona could sink this whole thing because she hasn't said if she's going to vote for it yet. So it's possible that this might go nowhere. But John's amendments question was
People will put amendments in. Well, they can say, hey, you know what? I heard Nicole. This is too complicated.
Well, I think
this is little bearings. This is I've made it easy. There's two decisions. That's it.
I think this is, if I'm not mistaken, I think this is a reconciliation bill, which is basically means it's going to be an up or down vote. They, at this point, there's no more amendments.
No more amendments.
Yeah, I think so, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But John's question was, he said, do you have an explanation on the proposed tax credit, which we just talked about? And he said, what current vehicles would qualify? Basically, anything built in North America, it will get something. And then is it only battery electric vehicles or do plug-in hybrids qualify as well? And plug-in hybrids do continue to qualify. But they have raised the minimum battery capacity. So it used to be a plug-in hybrid had to have at least 4 kilowatt-hour battery. It's now 7 kilowatt-hours under this bill. So it's almost double the size. So still pretty puny. I mean, I don't think there's any.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing at the fact that it was four.
Yeah.
It's like a bunch of 9 volts like shoved underneath.
Yeah.
Just I mean,
when this was done in 2009, you know, there was, you know, you had that first generation Toyota Prius plug-in, which had like a 4 kilowatt. It was just over 4 kilowatt-hour battery, which is basically useless. But plug-in hybrids will still be eligible. So let's go through this list from the bottom up.
Whoa.
Coach Cabrera asked, is the new Silverado EV only being offered in work truck and premium models? Where are the in-between versions? So there will be in-between versions. The work truck and the RST are the first two coming out. The work truck is supposed to come out next spring, and then the RST in the fall, and then LTs and ZR2s and other trim levels will become rolling out over the months following that, you know, into early 2024. So there will be a full range of trim levels.
They want to get the big money and then, like, well, also the big money with the fleets first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two big monies.
The two big monies.
Yep.
No whammies.
Okay. This one's for you, Nicole.
Yeah, it kind of
is. I'd like
is.
To hear about EV infrastructure in the Northeast. Ubiquitous in the Boston suburbs, but always seeing a dearth of EVs and chargers on or near, for example, Cape Cod and northern Vermont.
Yeah, so the EV infrastructure, if you're on a major highway, once you get a little bit further north, like, for example, in New Hampshire, like once you get to Concord, middle of the state, there's a huge section of EV chargers right off of the highway. You can get, there must be like 10 or 15 on each side of the highway. But then you get north of there, good luck with that. And it's randomly, very often randomly, like at some inn or some hotel somewhere that will have a couple of EV chargers, and they've sort of gone all in with it. I want to say that's the case in one spot in Vermont, and I can't remember where I stay, but like the hotel is like all prides itself on being green, so they've installed chargers for their hotel guests. It is harder to find them. The further you get up north, the harder it is to find. It can be next to impossible to find them in any quantity, where if there's one other guy who's charging, you've got a, you know, one charger with two plugs. So you have a very minimal number of options. It's getting better. I mean, it really is getting better. But once you get, you know, once you really get out of the really populous areas, which are the southern parts of New Hampshire and, you know, southern areas, you can find them sometimes. They're a little more prevalent in the heavily tourist areas, but it's still not a lot of them. You're still going to find just one or two. So if you're trying to charge your, you know, you have to plan. You really do have to plan. It's not like you can just plug in anywhere. So it's better than it was. It's still not great. Still not great. And during the wintertime, they are so very often just plowed right in that no one pays attention. The guy's plowing the last. And I don't think it's intentional. I honestly think they just don't know. I don't think they're looking and going, they think their brain is seeing big white thing. That's a sign. No one needs that. Not like big white thing. That's a charger. When people need that, you know? So, yeah.
Just travel with a shovel.
It's getting, yeah, really. It's getting better. And like you can find them in like a lot of the malls. It was a time when you'd have nothing in the malls. Now you'll find most malls have a couple. So you have to go to places. They aren't every place. You have to find little populous areas that have enough to warrant someone putting in a charger, I guess.
When you do find a charger at a hotel, is it usually, you know, a general purpose, you know, charger with a 1772 connector, or is it a Tesla destination charger?
I've seen some that have, I was at a couple of places that will have like a Tesla charger there, but then a couple of just generic, anybody can use this chargers. Because I have seen both at hotels, depending on the hotel and the inn. The larger ones, sometimes a larger resorty kind of place might have a little bit more. You get to an inn and they may have just said, well, we have an EV charger here at our inn for the one person who wants to plug in right now, and that's it. But again, it really varies from place to place. It's something if you're going up into the Northeast, if you said, like, you know, if you're going up to Vermont, if you're going, you know, if you're going really up into the Northeast, you have to look at where you're going and check the availability, excuse me, ahead of time. So you know what's available wherever you're heading. Is that loose?
Okay. All right. Next up, from Team Engineering, thoughts on the viability of the Hyundai Envision 74 hydrogen fuel cell stack for range extending EVs. Using a fuel cell as a range extender for EVs is something that's not a new idea. There's been a number of concepts over the years. In fact, back in early 2007, I had a chance to drive the Ford High Series Edge concept, which was exactly this. It had, I think it was about a 18 kilowatt hour battery pack, you know, that would give you about 50 miles, or they claimed about 50 miles of electric driving range from the plug, and then a hydrogen fuel cell to act as a range extender. And you know, there's been other concepts since then. Audi did, I think, an A7 a few years back with a similar type of setup. Mercedes has done something. And it's actually not a bad idea, you know, because fuel cells work better when they're running steady state instead of doing it, you know, up and down you know, transients, you know, as you accelerate and decelerate, and you can rely on the battery to do the transient stuff and then just use the fuel cell to keep it charged. You know, it's also a more expensive solution. So, I mean, it's, yes, it's technically feasible. Is it economically viable? You know, probably not so much.
I mean, when it comes, the fuel cell is still running an electric motor. I mean, if you get the Nexo, the fuel cell, and then it had a battery on it as well. So it's, you know, it's not like Hyundai hasn't done this before. They're just, this is, they've just supercharged what they're doing with the Envision 74, where you can have both of them in a, like, the coolest looking concept car that we've seen in like 10 years. It can happen, and it makes sense. I mean, South Korea. not North Korea. I don't know what's going on in North Korea. As the rest of us don't know anything. Anyway, South Korea, they have an actual hydrogen refueling infrastructure, unlike this country. So, you know, that's where Hyundai's based. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And you know, they can learn from this vehicle and have a lot of fun, and of course, make us all drool over the vehicle for the next 5 years, and then say, "Nah, we're not making that." Or maybe they will,
but not here.
Oh no, that'd be even worse.
See, that's the
would it be worse?
Right?
Would it be worse that they don't make it, or worse that they do make it, but North America doesn't get it? Which is worse?
Worse when you can't have it. It's like, look at that really cool thing there.
Well, you know, if at least if they made it, you know, there's the chance that at some point in time you could import one.
25 years later, or 21 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like the Honda 25. E? The Honda E?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. At least you can get it later on in 25 years.
Or if you move to Korea, you can get one.
Oh, that's true. All right. Well, there you go.
You just got to move to Korea.
But then again, the speed limit in Korea is like 12 miles an hour. Everything drives. I was in a mountain. I was on a mountain road, and the new Seoul EV, which they were going to bring to America, then they changed their mind not to. It was a fantastic little EV, and the speed limit was 30 kilometers an hour, which is 18 miles an hour.
Blazing along
on a mountain road. I was like, I'm going faster than that. I told my my drive partner, I'm not driving 18 miles an hour on this road. And they're like, yeah, that's fine.
We're not doing that speed limit. Thank you.
All right. Next up from And That. We're visiting the U.S., Minnesota, later in the month. Being a townie and scared of spiders, wolves, and loons. Not sure why you would be scared of loons, but, you know, spiders and wolves, I can understand.
Loons, yeah. Loons don't attack people. I've never seen a loon attack geese or mean little...
I guess the sound of a loon can be a little spooky if you're not used to it.
I find they're kind of nice, and they're pretty birds.
Anyway.
They just float along.
Or maybe they mean like loony people, like the Looney Tunes.
Oh, that could be.
I think they mean that. I don't think they mean the bird. Okay.
Anyway.
Anyway. My oldest son plans to sleep in the car rather than the cabin. Any tips for making his time in the back of our rental Suburban more comfortable?
A hotel.
Pillow?
I would think, you know, if you're staying in a cabin, that would probably be better and just as safe as sleeping in the back of the Suburban. But, you know, I mean, if the kid's got to sleep in the Suburban, you know, modern air mattresses, you know, that have a built-in pump are actually really good. We have one that we use when we have guests staying, like our daughter staying with us this week. You know, just you plug it in. Pumps it up in about 2-3 minutes, and you know it's nice and firm, and you know it's like almost like a real mattress. And so I would definitely you know, when you're not using it, it deflates, and you can roll it up into a fairly small package. So I would definitely consider getting an air mattress with a built-in pump.
I would say, and if you're depending on how late the people sleep in. It's going to be really bright inside that car as soon as the sun comes up because of all the windows. So something like either get some little towels or something that you can hang out, some way to provide or get them an eye mask.
Or a mask.
Something, an eye mask, because otherwise it's going to be bright. And when the sun comes up early in the summer, it's bright.
What's
you know, he's going to be sleeping in the car and up at 4 a.m. because the sun's up.
What's the temperature in Minnesota at the end of August? Like the day, like is it still hot? Is it still summer hot, or is it start getting cold?
I think it's still summer hot, isn't it?
Yeah, I would think. Yeah, you know, it's probably probably getting into the 50s at night. Yeah, you know, so not cold, but cooler.
Not too bad. They're not going to freeze.
As long as you got a good sleeping bag, it's fine.
Yeah, a sleeping bag, a nice air mattress.
Because actually, have you ever slept in a car? I mean,
a teenager, 20s. We used to go surfing all the time. What we'll do, because I'm from a mountain town, we would leave our work at like 1, 2 in the morning, drive to the ocean, sleep in the car. So I would just put the seat back in like my 90 Honda Civic hatchback, and there'd be three of us. So the people in the front and then the person in the back, we'd all just sort of scrunch up and like make sure our surfboards weren't stolen. We put them in the car, so we sleep underneath the surfboards in the car if they fit. God. And if they didn't, we just like hope for the best and leave the big one on top. So I've done that, and I've slept in the back of a WRX wagon, not with the back down, but just in the back seat. But I just had a pillow. I was at a hospital. I had a family member who was very sick. And I got there, and then it was, we did all the sick family member thing. And then like, okay. And then I was like, well, I don't know. I'm just going to sleep in my car. And so I just slept in.
So my thing is, if you sleep in the car in the summer, even if it's, it can get kind of hot if it's still warm. But also it gets very humid in the car because it's hot already outside. And then you have it all closed up. And imagine this poor kid's going to have every window, everything sealed completely tight to protect against the killer loons. Right? So and you've the got spiders. To think that it's going to get hot. So if there's some little fan, like a little portable fan or something, like little tiny ones, like you put on your desk almost, it runs in a bit. Something, because it's going to just get like, it's going to get really muggy in that car. You're going to have like condensation on the windows when you wake up in the morning.
Swampy.
Well, and you know, the thing is, you don't want to leave the windows open.
Because the spiders. You know,
well, I wouldn't worry about the spiders, but the mosquitoes are going to eat you alive.
Oh yeah, the mosquitoes and those loons. Yeah, once the loon can get like one of its like little bills in that in the open
they're like
window,
mice. Ooh. They're can in. Get really tiny. They can get through anything.
Yeah, really long tongues. They just reach down and they can unlock the door with their tongue. Yeah. And then the werewolves. So
don't tell them about the werewolves. Don't tell.
I mean, if it's in the guide for Minnesota. It's like right there.
It's on the first page.
On the first page.
It's in the foreword, I think.
Hey, yeah, Minnesota, we're awesome. By the way, werewolves.
All right. Another one from Team Engineering. Thoughts on Aptera's Tesla charger petition. So for those not familiar with this, do you know Aptera, the company trying to make this little three-wheeled teardrop-shaped thing? They were around in like 2007-08 and they went bankrupt about 2011 and they came back a couple of years ago and now they're putting solar cells all over the car and they're claiming 1,000 miles of driving range, with solar and everything. When they published the preliminary rules for the funding for EV charging infrastructure from the infrastructure bill, one of the things in there was that the chargers had to use CCS connectors, which is the industry standard for everybody except Tesla. And Aptera is putting out a petition, saying that, no, they want to use the Tesla charging port charging connector instead of CCS for no readily apparent reason. I don't know.
Just because.
Maybe they're hoping to get bought by Tesla. I like that their petition is like in the second graph. They say a recent study showed that Tesla superchargers provide the best EV charging experience. That's because they're everywhere and they have exactly one car they have to work with. That's it. Because of the charging. It's not because of the charging port.
Tesla controls the software in the charger and in the car. So, it's easy for them.
Yeah. And they decided long ago to put charging networks everywhere, which was a very smart thing to do. Because it's still, like right now, that is the number one reason to buy a Tesla. It's not any of the other stuff, because everyone else is essentially caught up to them when it comes to EVs. It's that charging network. If your friend, who's this person who wanted to go up, I don't know, somewhere northeast, wherever you live, Minnesota. Up there, North Vermont, I'm sure there's dozens of Tesla chargers that person could just drive to and be totally fine.
Yeah, there are a lot more Tesla chargers. If you're looking for Tesla chargers, they're way easier to find. They are very conveniently located somewhere on your main route.
See? That's
they're putting like 10 of them in the mall across the street from the big mall. They're putting in like there must be like 10 at least. It seems like
that's the killer app of the is the Tesla charging network. But it's not because of their charging port. It's the fact that they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. They made a smart decision.
Yeah, I mean Tesla already uses CCS in Europe because they're required to, and it hasn't changed the charging experience over there. So it's you're right. It's not about the port. It's about all the other pieces of the puzzle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Surter asks, how will the customer base change for the Charger and Challenger if it goes EV? Not if, when. But how different are the Mach-E and Mustang ICE customers from each other? Is there overlap?
I live in Northern California, so I think there is some overlap because I live in Northern California, and EVs are just a dime a dozen now. They're all over the place. But that said, having grown up with people who are really into muscle cars, family members, friends, etc., being from a small town, there are a lot of people who will never buy another Challenger or Charger again once it goes EV.
Because people do say that, like hardcore Mustang folks say that about the Mustang. It's not a Mustang. The Mach-E is not a Mustang. I will never buy one. They have, you know, tarnished the Mustang brand forever. And no way. I will never. There are a lot of people. So I can imagine the same thing's going to happen with the Dodge, the Charger and Challenger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People attach their identities and their personalities to parts of their lives. Like some people attach it to Tesla or to Apple or to Android. And for the muscle car guys and gals, it's the same thing. They've attached their personality to a muscle car, which is a big, loud V8 and horrible, horrible handling. And that's fine.
So
I love muscle cars, but I know their limitations. There you go.
Yeah. So if you must have a V8 Charger or Challenger, buy it between now and the end of 2023, because after that, it's gone. The Hellcat is going out of production next year, and the Hemis will probably follow it close behind. The next generation Charger and Challenger coming in 2024 will not have a big V8, but they will be faster.
Yeah, that's the thing. They're going to be quicker. And the cat might be that cat. Remember that cat from the battery ads when we were little kids? The little electric cat? Oh, if they could get the licensing for that little electric.
The electric cat?
It's like a black cat. Ads? It was like a black cat and had its back arched.
I think it was a Duracell.
I think it might have been Duracell. Anyway, it was a battery manufacturer.
Yeah.
They had the cat. And he's like he looks like a lightning bolt.
It was Ever Ready. I just googled. It was Ever Ready. Okay. Because it had 9 lives.
Nine lives. There you go.
That was the little advertising because I'm looking at it now.
There's going to be a lot of Hellcats, EV Hellcats, that have that sticker plastered on. And they're going to be at the track, and they're going to make you feel really sad when they outrun your current Hellcat.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But they won't make the cool noise, so you got that going for you. You're like, yeah, but you can't do this.
All right. Last question. Well, actually, you can make that noise because you can program them to make any noise you want.
You could make it sound cooler than a Hellcat.
Oh.
You could, yeah.
Could you? What's cooler than a Hellcat? I don't know. Come up with that, Dodge. Make it sound cooler than a Hellcat.
You can make it sound like a Hellcat.
You can make it sound
like
a Hellcat.
It has to sound cooler than. It has to be better than. Yeah.
Just dog
otherwise,
barking.
It's not an imp-
Happy birthday song.
All right. Last one for this week from Fozzie B.
We should not record this late.
Looking for the team's feedback on level 2 chargers. There are so many and the costs vary widely. Any thoughts on options, features to whittle it down to 2 or 3?
Oh, gosh.
Robbie, weren't you just doing some testing?
I'm doing testing on some chargers. I have the Juice box from Enel or Enel. Anyway, I have Electrify America's home charger, and I have ChargePoint's home charger. And I'm doing a big review for Wired for these, which requires a lot of charging and more charging and sticking things to the walls of my house and doing. Anyway, so I think for most people, if you're probably going to want like a 50 amp circuit in your house, so you can get a 40 amp charger. It'll go up to 9.6 kilowatts per hour. And overnight, I mean, I charged Ford F-150 Lightning with it. No big deal. And I think, you know, if you want something quicker, you can get something quicker. You can get like 100 amp systems. You can get, you know, I think Ford's going to have something that's just ridiculous and charges really quick. And Lucid will have something that's ridiculous and charges really quick. But for the most part, those three are sort of the big three right now. A lot of automakers are also making their own. And so you can get those as well. Really, the whole point of having the home charger is that, A, you can just check your phone and see how it's charging. You can keep track of, you know, how much money you're spending. Some of them have that. You can also set it up with scheduling, which is nice if you live in an area where your electricity costs are different depending on the time of day. There's different tiers. In the middle of the night, our electricity is like half the cost of it, what it is during the day. So having a home charger and saying, hey, I only want you to charge from midnight until noon or 9 a.m. in the morning or 6 a.m. in the morning is great, because you know that you're only getting charged when the electricity is the least expensive. And you can also like override that if you really need a charge. What's nice about the level 2 chargers is that in the instances where you do need, you know, you have been driving around a ton, and in a few hours, you know, you get home, and in a few hours, you have to go somewhere else. It is nice to sort of just plug it in while you're at home, you know, unpacking or doing whatever you have to do, and then turn around and take off and take care of other errands in the house. That's where, because it's not going to cost you any more to charge your vehicle if you're using a level 2 charger versus just plugging it into the regular socket, because you're using the same amount of electricity. It's just you're getting it quicker. That's the whole thing. And they are, you know, going to be expensive. I mean, for me, getting the outlet put in was like $700 and something, which I found out is about the average. So that's, you know, it's a lot to you know, sort of lay out. So you're like, hey, I'm saving all this money on an electric car, and you're like, oh wait, hold on. There's these other things,
but you only have to do that once, considering
how expensive gas has gotten, especially here. I drive my BRZ for fun, but for like errands, I take our Kona electric, just because gas is so expensive and electricity is far cheaper. And it's, you know, again, if gas was $5 a gallon, which it's not here, it would cost me $18 to drive 100 miles in my BRZ. It costs $6 to drive it in the Kona. Wow. So,
and I mean, to you know, you mentioned that it doesn't cost you any more to charge from a 240 versus a 120. Actually, it can actually be cheaper from a 240, because most the onboard chargers in EVs are typically optimized for 240 volt flow versus, and so a lot of times you actually end up getting more losses when you're charging from 120 right. volts.
You are correct. So I forgot all about that.
With 120, you might actually end up using a little bit more electricity. You're going to get the same amount of electricity going into the battery, but it's going to consume more because of the losses in the conversion. So it's actually more efficient typically to use a 240. Actually, I just saw something. I'll have to find the link, and I'll include it in the show notes. There's a company now that is making a device that goes in between. It plugs in between the meter and the socket that your electric meter plugs into on the outside of your house or your garage. Essentially, what it does is it taps in right at the meter. So it's the meter's still measuring, you know, all your electricity use, but it gives you a 240 volt outlet right at the meter, so that you don't actually have to do any electrical upgrades in your house or run an outlet from your panel in your house into your garage or to the outside of your house. So this device is about $500 or $600. So it's cheaper typically than an electrician. And, you know, if you have an older house, you know, if you have, you know, only 100 amp service in your house, you'll want to upgrade that to 200 amps before you install a 240 volt outlet. But with this device, you don't have to do that upgrade because it plugs in right at the meter. I'll find it and include it in the show notes. That's another potential solution. The other thing to keep in mind is, think about, check out the EVs that you're thinking about buying, because a lot of EVs now are bundling a charging cable that has mm-hmm. interchangeable tips on it that actually supports 240 volt. So, you don't actually, for example, all the Ford EVs, the Mach-E and the Lightning, come with a 240 volt capable cable, but it's got an interchangeable tip, so you can plug it into a 120 outlet if you need to, or into a 240 outlet. The Lightning, if you get the Lightning with the extended range battery, it actually comes bundled with their Charge Station Pro, which is an 80 amp, 19.2 kilowatt charger. So you get that with the truck, and you just need to have the outlet put in your garage. And then those chargers, those 19 kilowatt chargers, typically cost about $2,000. They include that with the truck, so you don't have to buy that extra. And then the Mach-E comes with a 9.6 kilowatt. If the car you're buying, most EVs have the ability to do the scheduling right in the car or from an app that's connected to your car. So, again, you don't necessarily need to have a charger that has that connectivity and a separate app for the charger. You can do it from the car. You can control it from the car and do that scheduling of when you want to charge. And so, the charger that I bought is actually, it's Electron 9.6 kilowatt 40 amp charging cable. It doesn't have any connectivity or any smarts. It's got a display on it, so it tells me, how much current and voltage I'm getting when I plug it in. And then when it's all done charging, it shows me how many kilowatt hours it transferred to the car. But I don't get any connectivity to the charger itself. It just shows me on the thing there, but I can control scheduling from whatever car is plugged in. And that one was only $300 on Amazon. Yeah. So
a bargain.
A bargain. Yeah. Do remember though, if you buy the Lightning and the Maverick, or not the Maverick, the Mach-E, you're gonna have to, if you don't have that 240 volt outlet, you're gonna have to get an electrician to come and still put in that 200 volt. That Lightning, you're gonna need a 100 amp dedicated circuit just for the charger that comes with the Lightning with the extended battery. And the Mach-E 9.6, you're going to need a 50 amp because you want to do 20% higher than the amp it's being used, blah, blah. The electrician will tell you all that stuff about it. Eventually, you just got to call an electrician. Don't burn your house down. That's my thing.
Yes.
There's a lot of things you can do in your house. You can
unless you are a licensed electrician, do not do this yourself.
Oh, God, no.
Get a licensed electrician to do it.
Do not.
Hey, if you can hang a picture in your house, great. You can replace the door, outstanding. But unless you're a certified electrician, don't mess with electricity because it'll kill
don't
you.
Mess with that.
Or burn your house down. One of those, there's a couple.
Or both, burn your house down and kill you.
you are the kindling that burnt down your house.
All right, with that, let's call it a show, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. Bye.